From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum evaluates the future of Milwaukee County's 90-year-old public safety building and how it could be replaced.
The estimates are that you would need $40 to $50 million worth of work just to try to keep it in its current functionality, which again is very low functionality. So to really make it something worth using, the only solution is to tear it down and build a new one.
Later, a new book and photography exhibit spotlights the work of a longtime trained photographer who once called Milwaukee home.
You had streamlined passenger trains on the Milwaukee Road and the Chicago and Northwestern that had really some of the state-of-the-art equipment, very top-notch service, multiple trains a day. So it was this really kind of halcyon period, and Abby was there right in the middle of that.
And a conversation with a legendary Johnny Mathis ahead of his concert at the Riverside Theater on Friday night.
Like Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee County's public safety building is long past the point where it is simply aging. The building was built with a jail inside in 1929. Prisoners were moved to a newer facility more than 25 years ago, and the building now mainly houses courtrooms and legal offices.
And while nearly everyone agrees that there needs to be a plan for the public safety complex's future, there is no plan currently in place. The Wisconsin Policy Forum has just released a report on several potential financing plans for a new facility. Rob Henkin is president of the forum, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Before we get to the issues in funding a new public safety building, let's talk about the state of the old one. Why is this the time to do this work?
So this is a building that was constructed in 1929. It originally housed all sorts of jail and public safety functions. Over the years, it also housed courthouse functions. So over the years, as the historic courthouse part of the courthouse complex has housed many of the courts, as different public safety functions have sort of gone elsewhere, this has essentially become office space for district attorneys and for sheriff staff. And it is a building that clearly is not meeting the county's needs, number one. Number two, it's an old building with lots of deferred maintenance. The county has known for quite some time that it really needed to make a decision on whether to try to somehow renovate and repair as opposed to just replacing. That decision has been put off. The deferred maintenance has piled up, and we're now at the point where something has to be done.
So it sounds like it's not serving anybody's purpose at this point.
Correct. And the estimates are that you would need $40 to $50 million worth of work just to try to keep it in its current functionality, which again is very low functionality. So to really make it something worth using, the only solution is to tear it down and build a new one.
What is the county missing out on by having the kind of piecemeal approach that it has today?
Well, in terms of, the county has all sorts of struggles with its overall capital improvements program. This has been one of the most vexing elements of the county's budget. There's been such a dire need to control annual debt service because of all the county's operating budget challenges that has forced it to limit the amount of borrowing that it does on an annual basis. And the amount of borrowing that the county has deemed affordable has not jived with its capital needs. So we see a big backlog of capital projects across the board. And really, the safety building is emblematic, where, boy, we know we need to make a big decision here. We don't have the resources to do anything big. Then again, we don't want to pump money that we don't have into a building that we're going to replace anyway, so nothing happens. The mental health complex is a similar situation. And so this is really, in some respects, it can't be helped, but in other respects, it's just not doing anyone any good.
This is like the question, do I put new brakes on my car? Do I put new tires on my car? Do I, fix the steering in the car? If I know I'm just going to have to do three more projects, maybe I should just buy a new car.
Exactly. But ultimately, that car is going to break down on you, and then you have a problem.
So clearly, I know one of the things that the Wisconsin Policy Forum does often is consider what other municipalities have done in similar projects. Milwaukee County is not alone in this issue, right?
Correct. And so this was actually Milwaukee County coming to us and saying, can we commission you to do some research that's going to explore how other urban counties across the country have gone about building new courthouses. These are huge projects that, generally speaking, are not going to be affordable, I don't care what size the county is, as part of one's regular capital improvements program. So how has that worked elsewhere? And so that was the beginning for this analysis. We scanned across the country. We found 14 courthouse or similar to courthouse type projects across the country at a total price tag of $100 million or more that had either been initiated or completed since 2010. And so we took a look first at those 14 projects to try to gain some insight. How have these other counties gone about with these very big capital projects?
Well, and so talk about what some of the creative ways that other counties have gone about doing these kinds of projects are.
Well, the most striking thing when you look across the country is that, indeed, very few have done it the traditional way. So the traditional way is simply, again, to issue generally 15-year general obligation debt as part of your regular capital program, pay off those bonds over 15 years, and somehow come up with the resources to do that. In this case, when we are talking about projects and the average cost of these projects, about $260 million, which is actually the projected construction cost for a new justice center for Milwaukee County. For projects of that magnitude, something different has occurred. So we see instances in which state government has given special authorization to local governments to do special sales taxes or special court fees to pay off the bonds. We have seen examples of public-private partnership where the public sector has turned to private entities to finance, and then essentially the bonds are repaid as part of availability payments that also comprise essentially rental payments for the structures. We've seen other instances in which state government has recognized that courts are both a county and a state function, and where the state has chipped in to pay for half or so of the cost.
Well, and so what? Give us a sense for why doing things the way a normal capital project might be done, just, you know, the 15-year general obligation bonds, why is that not an ideal way to go about something of this magnitude?
So for Milwaukee County, the total cost of this project is projected to be about $340 to $360 million. Now, I had said $260 million earlier, but you have to add on to that demolition costs, and you have to add transition costs because the county has to move hundreds of people out of the safety building for some period of time. But what we figured was about a $300 million borrowing amount is a good guess. To put that into perspective, Mitch, if the county was to issue 15-year debt at current interest rates, we project that the annual debt service on that would be about $25.6 million per year. For the county to have to come up with an additional $25.6 million for 15 consecutive years, that will mean either it will really not have resources to do virtually anything else in terms of capital improvements to all of its parks and its other buildings and facilities and roads and so forth, or you would see this monstrous operating budget challenge that would produce some very substantial cuts in services.
And the county is already facing plenty of challenges even without this.
Yes. And so, again, just for more context, right now the county is spending about $30 million annually on debt service for its capital debt. If you add 25.6, it almost doubles it.
One of the other possibilities you looked at is the idea of a public-private partnership. Has that been put into practice in other places?
We are seeing increased use of public-private partnerships, but for the most part, where we're seeing those is when the subject of the partnership is a project that itself is generating revenue that can pay off the debt that is needed to finance the project. So the perfect example is a highway project where the public sector teams up with the private sector. The private sector actually pays for the highway improvements and potentially even is transferred through a lease, basic ownership of the highway, but they are the ones that get to erect the toll booths so that you have the revenues coming in to pay off the debt. For courthouse projects and big buildings that don't have that type of revenue generating capacity, we see less frequent use, but we were actually able to find of the 14 projects that I mentioned that we identified, two did use public-private partnerships. One was in Long Beach, California, and the other in outside of Baltimore, Maryland.
What about the idea of additional revenue sources, either new taxes or kinds of fees that might be imposed?
So again, the fundamental problem is, assuming that the county is going to have to borrow money to do this, how can it afford these debt service payments? So clearly, if there was to be the enactment of some new special funding source, then that at least doesn't create the problem where by doing this project, the county is crowding out its other capital needs or creating insurmountable operating budget challenges. So to pay for that $25.6 million per year, what could you do? Well, clearly what we have seen in other communities, we have found a couple places in Florida and one in Georgia, where a special temporary half-cent to one-cent sales tax could potentially generate the revenue necessary either to cash finance the project over a short period of time, in which case you don't incur interest costs, or again, if you if the payments are not of that magnitude and you want to pay it off over 15, 20, or 30 years, to use a lower amount of sales tax to pay the debt service for the project.
One of the other angles you point to is potentially extending the Miller Park tax and then reappropriating it, clearly.
Yes. So again, first of all, it goes without saying, in order for Milwaukee County to have such a special tax, you would need state authorization. And state government has certainly shown no inclination at this point to give local governments that type of special sales tax authority. That being said, there is a special sales tax already in place in Milwaukee County, plus four other counties. It's the Miller Park sales tax. It's a tenth of a cent. It is due to expire once the debt for Miller Park is paid off, which should occur in 2019 or 2020. And so, purely hypothetically speaking, if you were to keep that one-tenth of a cent in place in Milwaukee County for some period of time to pay off the debt service for a new public safety building, that could be a viable approach. Now, we estimate that that tax would raise about $15 million per year. So if you were using traditional general obligation 15-year bonds, it may not be enough. Now, here's where perhaps you could combine that with some special court fees. We have seen places across the country that have done traffic fine and court surcharges for users of the courts that builds up money that can be used for projects like this.
Almost like tolls on highways.
Well, exactly. And so, again, there's some merit in asking the users to pay. The problem is that most of the users of the court system perhaps don't have the means to pay extra court fees. And then one other possibility would be to extend the life of the bonds. And there are pros and cons of doing that. But instead of doing 15-year debt, if you were to do 20-year debt for general obligation bonds or perhaps 30-year revenue bond debt, then that tenth of a cent sales tax revenue stream could hypothetically be sufficient to pay off the bonds.
How about naming rights?
Well, hey, I'm sure that's one option that ultimately will be looked at.
Rob, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can find a link to the forum's report on financing plans for a new county justice center at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we'll learn about a new book that showcases the work of an iconic train photographer. Keep listening. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Wallace Abbey captured images of trains and how railroads played a role in shaping large cities for decades, beginning in the 1940s. And in doing that, the late photographer chronicled not just how the railroad industry changed over 70 years, but how our culture shifted as well.
More than 100 of Abbey's spectacular and sometimes intimate images of trains are collected in a new book. Wallace W. Abbey, A Life in Railroad Photography, features interpretation and other texts by Milwaukee-based journalist Kevin Keefe and by Scott Lotus, the president and executive director of the Madison-based Center for Railroad Photography and Art.
They spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about the project, and Lotus explained what got the project going.
The book's edited by the Center for Railroad Photography and Art, a nonprofit based in Madison, and one of our several initiatives is to collect photographs, but also to showcase them. And so publications really flow naturally from that. Abbey has a great history in Milwaukee. He worked there as an associate editor for Trains magazine in the early 1950s and produced a stunning body of work, and not only there, but in a long public relations career that followed. And that work hasn't been seen very widely in the public. And so this was a great way to not only re-examine some of his work from the 1950s at Trains Magazine, but also go out and, you know, really dig through his archive and pull out some wonderful photographs that very few people had seen before.
Had he ever done public exhibitions, or was this more of a hobby for him?
As much as I can tell, this is the first time this has ever been done for him. He was just really getting going on a freelance career after he retired, but his health declined rather quickly, and it was kind of a struggle for him to do that sort of thing afterwards.
So the photographs in here really were him doing it because he just loved trains.
Yeah, at first, although in the case of the Trains Mag— well, actually, in the case of all his jobs, at Trains Magazine, that was his job, was to go out on the field and report on the railroad industry in a very exciting time, the early 50s, not only take pictures, but write long stories for the magazine. And then when he went on into railroad public relations, taking photographs was also a big part of the job. But he certainly also did it, you know, out of a pure love of doing it as well.
And he wasn't doing it sort of as quote-unquote art photography. He was doing it as part of his reporting and his job.
Yeah, I think what was driving him was his instincts as a photojournalist more than anything. But he also, as you can tell from the book, had an eye for something deeper than that, something artistic, if you will.
It's so interesting to look through his corporate work because time and again, you could see very clearly the, you know, kind of the annual report cover photograph that his employer sent him out to take. But then at the same time, he would often go off and go through three or four more rolls of film shooting whatever he wanted to at the same place. You know, he had this great access to the railroad environment thanks to his job. But then he also had a journalistic and really kind of an artistic eye to go out and capture photographs to his own liking that really augmented the corporate work he was being paid to do.
So what was his relation to Milwaukee? You know, why was he here?
In about 1950, he got a job with Trains Magazine, which was over at 1027 North 7th Street on the edge of downtown. He was there for many, many years. And he'd gotten a degree at Kansas in journalism and worked for a small newspaper in Kansas for a year. And then Al Kalmbach, the owner and founder of the company, came a-calling. And Wally came to work for Trains about 1950 and worked for nearly 4 years there. So this was a really important time in this young guy's life. And it was also an important time in the history of the magazine, which then was starting to be led by a legend in our field, David P. Morgan, the editor, who was also a mentor of Wally's and a friend.
Well, it was also a boom time for trains in the United States in general, is it not?
There was this great sort of post-war optimism that really sort of pervaded the entire country. But within the railroad industry, there was this great hope that with new equipment and better services, they could continue to sort of maintain the high levels of passenger travel that had, you know, been in the country for the late 19th and the first half of the 20th century. Sadly, a lot of that optimism proved to be unfounded as more and more Americans began driving or flying. But in the 1950s, there was this sort of brief window in time when a lot of people were still traveling by train and all of the railroads were upgrading their equipment. So in Milwaukee, you had streamlined passenger trains on the Milwaukee Road and the Chicago and Northwestern that had really some of the state-of-the-art equipment, very top-notch service, multiple trains a day. So it was this really kind of halcyon period, and Abby was there right in the middle of that.
And Wally, I think, shows a lot of that by virtue of his interest in taking people pictures, too. He wasn't like a lot of railroad photographers who focus on equipment and infrastructure and all that sort of stuff. He really wanted to put people in the context of the railroad, railroad workers, passengers on the train. So in the book, you'll see a lot of photographs of people in small, intimate little moments that seem to carry some meaning beyond that, and that's the kind of eye he brought to the camera.
There's a fantastic photograph that he took of two little boys in their saddle shoes watching a Chicago and Northwestern train at the old Lakefront Depot, you know, right off of downtown, right where the Summerfest grounds stand today. And it's just so interesting to think, I mean, by the time those kids grew up, that depot would have been gone, the passenger trains would have been gone, and yet it's this just beautiful image, and the two kids are completely captivated by this form of technology that was sort of at its epitome at the time, but was, you know, soon to disappear.
And I happen to just randomly turn to page 190 and 191 in the book, and here's a sort of a wide-angle lens shot of businessmen coming off the Milwaukee Road double-decker train, and then facing that is operator Scott Perinsky hanging order for a westbound train, and you see kind of the scale of the trains against the human scale as well.
Yeah, I think that's something that really drove Wally. He was intimately familiar with the railroad, so he knew where to go to find people in a likely pose. And certainly that's especially true of workers, because he'd been one himself in the late 1940s when he was in college at the University of Kansas. He had a number of summer jobs in the Chicago area where he grew up, working for a couple of different railroads. And so he knew his way around, and he knew these people, and he knew how to portray them.
How long did it take for the two of you to put this book together and to choose which images that you wanted to include?
Quite a while. We got the collection in 2010, and the book just came out this winter. There's about 23,000 black and white negatives in the collection, and we had to get all of those rehoused, scanned, digitized, and then take the time to really go through them and try to pick out the best to really represent Abby's work. So it was, certainly that was not the only thing we were doing, but it's something that we've been working on off and on for several years.
Yeah, and I was helped along. We should have all the credits correct here. Scott really conceived of the book and did all the processing and editing of the photographs, wrote the captions, chose the photographs, and I was there to write the narrative, which is a brief biography of Wally in six different sections. We were helped along by the fact that Wally was an interesting guy. He was a bit self-reverential, and he left behind a rather vast archive of paper filled with resumes and short autobiographical essays and little observations about things like music and Chicago and, of course, railroads. And he was a witty guy, and so I had a lot of stuff to draw from to write this thing. But once it came time to do the book, we had to do it rather quickly. Our publisher, Indiana University Press, set a deadline for us, and we had about 2 months to get it done. And that was early last year. So it was a lot of fun, but there was some pressure.
So what's happening with those 23,000 archival photographs? Is that something that is online now that people can research?
Well, we've slowly been adding selections from Abby's collection to our website. We have just a gallery of highlights there right now. But now that the book's out, we plan to go back and start pulling more galleries online. The center's a nonprofit institution, and our archives are available to the public for research and for use in other projects. And we hope that this book will sort of be the tip of the iceberg and will encourage other people to take a deep dive into this collection and see what they can find in it. I think there's the material for several more books waiting to be mined here.
And one of the things you are going to do is you're going to be presenting a public talk here at the Grumman Museum at MSOE. What do you hope to tell people about? I mean, obviously the book itself, but are you hoping to generate more interest in railroads in general, or Abby in particular, or both?
Well, certainly this is part of our mission of the Center for Railroad Photography and Art, of showing this railroad imagery as something worthy of not only preservation, but a lot more attention. But we also want to talk about Wally, too. It's great that we're doing this in Milwaukee, because even though he lived here for only a brief time, the city meant a lot to him, and of course it's meant a lot to this community over the decades because of the presence of Trains Magazine here, which is the leading magazine in the world on the subject. So, and my own personal feeling is, too, I like to talk about Wally as a journalist. He really had a reporter's instincts. Even though he spent most of his career in PR, he really was a terrific magazine writer, and he knew how to dig, and obviously he knew how to take photographs.
And to add to that, his photographs really take you behind the scenes to show the people and the infrastructure that made the trains run. And, in our 21st century digital world, things like trains are operating behind the scenes and not really part of the fabric of everyday American existence. And yet they're still profoundly important to our economy and to life as we know it. That's something we're trying to do at the center, is just shine more of a light on that so that we can all understand how our world operates, what's significant, and what this technology is still able to do for us.
So tell me about the cover photograph.
Well, that is a photograph taken down at approximately the corner of 2nd Street and Clybourne. And it doesn't look anything like that now. That's where 794 is, and not far from the new streetcar line. Although in the photograph, the public service building still stands there behind the Milwaukee Road passenger train that you see there. And of course, in the distance, you see this tall, multi-spired Gothic rock pile that was the Milwaukee Road train station right off Zeidler Park, now the home of the We Energies Annex. So about 75% of what's in that photograph now is gone, but that gives you a wonderful sense of how busy that little piece of downtown was back in the day when the Milwaukee Road probably had 20 or 24 trains a day each way coming in and out of that train shed, you see.
I have to say, I'm sorry I didn't get to see that.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's a stunning building. It's absolutely beautiful. And the train is one of several a day that ran and competed very, very strongly for passenger business between the Twin Cities and Chicago. They were running those on about 6-hour schedules on the 400 miles between Chicago and the Twin Cities at that time, which is 2 hours faster than the one train a day Amtrak's Empire Builder is able to make that same run now.
Yeah. And when you think about it, it's what? 70 years later?
Something like that.
60.
Yeah. And you think, wait.
And what's amazing to me, too, is just several blocks east of that photograph, the same little scenario was being played out every day at the Northwestern Depot on the lakefront with its own wide selection of trains to Green Bay and to the Twin Cities and to South Dakota and places like that. So that's
only
a remarkable...
Into the Northwoods of the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bygone era, and it's unfortunate. But I'm so glad that we have these photographs. I understand there's also another Milwaukee connection that Abby had. And can you talk about that, Scott?
Absolutely. So in addition to these, you know, wonderful passenger trains, there was a little branch line of the Milwaukee Road that Wally photographed pretty extensively in the early 1950s. It wandered north of downtown along the riverfront area, and it was called the Beer Line. And it was called the Beer Line because it served the Schlitz, Blatz, and Pabst breweries. And at the time, these three breweries combined were shipping out about 50 carloads of beer every day. And Wally put his journalistic hat on, went out into the field, and came back with these just wonderfully evocative photographs of the factories, of workers loading and unloading the cars, of the grain arriving, and the, you know, the dust of the grain billowing up as the cars are unloaded, and conveyor belts taking cases of beer straight into the insulated boxcars for delivery all over the country. And so it's this just kind of wonderful slice of life of Milwaukee's blue-collar working-class history and the importance of the beer industry to the city, and also the importance of railroads to the beer industry. And so we actually developed an ancillary exhibition in addition to the main show at the Grohmann Museum called Milwaukee's Beer Line. And that will also be part of the show at the Grohmann Museum. And then it's also been traveling on its own to several breweries in Madison and Milwaukee. And we hope to continue that this fall.
Kevin and Scott, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Best of luck with your talks.
Thanks very much.
It's been our pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Kevin Keith and Scott Lotus wrote the text for the new book, Wallace W. Abbey, A Life in Railroad Photography. They spoke with Bonnie North. Abbey, who died in 2014, was a longtime photographer and an editor at Milwaukee-based Trains Magazine in the 1950s.
Keith and Lotus will talk about the new book Friday evening at the opening of an exhibition of Abbey's photographs at the Grohmann Museum on the campus of the Milwaukee School of Engineering. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com.
When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Wallace Abbey chronicled the changing of eras in the railroad industry over 7 decades. Over the next few minutes, Lake Effect essayist Marnie Mamenga chronicles the end of another era very close to home.
It was always a bit messy, nothing too serious. A few crumbs on the counter, a cabinet door ajar, a couple of dishes sitting in the sink, a trail of something scattered across the floor. But I didn't mind. It didn't need to be spick and span or glistening perfect. What was best about my kitchen was that it was a happy gathering place. Yet, after 38 years of the same cabinets and floor plan, we've decided to shake it up. We've cooked up a new recipe for a more open space, lighter cabinets, an island, and my favorite, a built-in desk that doubles as a party bar. What's not to like about that? Nevertheless, I have to admit that saying goodbye to the old kitchen has not been easy. It's like a dear old friend is leaving you, one you've wined and dined with for years and whose every aging idiosyncrasy you've known by heart, but loved regardless. For decades, its U-shaped framework had been an ongoing three-count waltz, fridge, sink, stove, again and again as breakfasts, lunches, and dinners beckoned. Over 30 consecutive Thanksgiving dinners graced its counters. Vast numbers of potluck platters plopped down on its perimeter fed untold gatherings for family and friends. When my three sons were growing up, the muted thuds of the same old cupboard doors opening and closing echoed within its snug confines from morning to night like a kind of staccato musical refrain set on replay. But more importantly, a kitchen, of course, is not just about food. Around its sink, a myriad of other activities not involving recipes took place. Here is where the dishwashers shared heartfelt confidences, where friends and family gathered to party no matter how tiny the space, where tears sometimes fell or wounds were washed. It is where my babies first bathed, and now it is where my grandchildren place their backyard wildflower bouquets upon its counters. But mostly it is where my husband and I stood side by side to fix or clean up a meal for close to 4 decades. I do not give up this space lightly. Right across from the sink counter was a small dining area anchored by a Chicago Board of Education library table found at a local flea market, which created a welcoming space to feed a family of 5, as well as to naturally stimulate discussions on what had been learned that day at school. In addition to meals, this library kitchen table was a perfect spot to do homework, decorate Christmas cookies, color Easter eggs, carve pumpkins, create eclectic art, polish silverware, and say a nightly grace. And now it is all gone. The old kitchen is but a hollowed-out shell of 2x4s and gutted drywall, much like the picked-over bones of a deliciously devoured turkey. I sigh. I will miss my old sagging shelves, the squeaky, lazy Susan that was too lazy to spin anymore, and most of all, the cupboard doors worn by loving hands. It was a wonderful 38 years of movable feasts. And yet, it is time for a kitchen facelift if we are going to continue to cook and entertain in its lovely space, which we hope to do in the years to come. Airy and open, the new plan calls for more of a line dance than a waltz, with my kitchen sink now located under a window where the dishwasher can watch the sun traverse a blue sky or the stars and moon light up the night. A more centrally located all-purpose island replaces the old library kitchen table, which has been repurposed to our den, a perfect spot for it to go back to its original intent, although an occasional meal and/or grandchild art project will surely continue to grace its well-worn hard oak surface. On the night before the kitchen's demise, I felt I needed to at least symbolically say goodbye to this old space. And so, as I gently wiped down the old counter configuration one more time, I realized that despite the work and effort to organize a meal, the shopping, the molding, the putting away, the preparing, the cooking, the cleaning up, what a privilege and honor it is to share a repast with loved ones. My 3-point waltz around that kitchen has fed my heart with more meals of love and togetherness than I could ever dream of on a silver platter. Gratefully, more meals and togetherness beckon, and so with open arms I greet my new dance partner, a line dance I will learn. In its newly bright light and clean open space, I will relish the opportunity to dish up good food to family and friends. But more importantly, I hope for all who gather here to find, once again, a happy space. To that end, just like Hansel and Gretel, I might scatter a few crumbs about as a welcome mat back home.
Lake Effect essayist Marnie Mominga is author of 2 books, Return to Wake Robin and On a Clear Night.
One more break and then a conversation with the legendary singer Johnny Mathis ahead of his concert Friday night in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view.
Chances are you might be familiar with both this song and the person who made it famous. Johnny Mathis emerged from a humble upbringing in San Francisco to record his first song in 1955. And he has never left the public stage since. Mathis, along with names like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett, have provided the romantic soundtrack to life around the world for generations.
Billboard magazine lists him as the number 6 selling album artist of all time. Mathis continues to record new music and perform for audiences, including the crowd that will gather at the Riverside Theater on Friday night. We had the great pleasure of speaking with Johnny Mathis from his home ahead of that show. Johnny Mathis, it is a great honor to speak with you.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Well, so I wanted to start in a strange place because I have known your music for a long time, but I don't think I knew until I started preparing for this interview that before you were a famous singer, you were a champion high jumper. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, kids like in school do a lot of crazy stuff, and I did, of course. I got involved in politics. I was the president of student body, but I was a high jumper and a hurdler on the track team, and my big claim to fame was that I had an outside chance of making the Olympics as a high jumper. But during that the week that I was to try to qualify for the Olympics, I got a chance to make my first recording in New York. So instead of going to the trials for the Olympics, I went to the trials for my career, and fortunately, everything worked out.
Well, right. These were both fields that there are no guarantees. Did music seem like the more secure option for you?
Oh, my goodness. My dad was right there with me all the time and says, well, son, we'll give it a shot. We'll see what happens. Anyway, good things happened, and that's that.
Well, good things really did happen. You mentioned your dad, and I was also reading that the first piano your family owned, that your dad actually had to disassemble it and then reassemble it to get it in the front door?
Our apartment that we lived in, I lived in it with my six brothers and sisters, and there were always a couple of relatives who were migrating from the South to San Francisco who were staying with us. And let's see, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rooms and about 12 people. And my dad showed up at the house one day with a bunch of wood or sticks or something and put it together, and it became a piano. And we all heard my dad play the piano for the first time. We had no idea. But when he was a kid, he was a singer and played the piano. So that was the beginning of my career. My dad was my best pal. Always. I have a lot of wonderful memories of my dad and how we started out and what he used to tell me. Come on, son, let's try this. Let's go over here and sing for this. Maybe somebody will hear you. Fortunately, somebody heard me.
You signed your first recording contract with Columbia in, I think it was 1955. Do you have any recollection of the expectations that the label had from you then?
Well, I was signed to Columbia Records by the head of jazz. His name was George Avakian, a dear, dear man who just recently passed away. He was almost 100 years old.
Wow.
But he was in the head of jazz, and he thought that perhaps he heard me sing in a jazz club in San Francisco when I was 17 or 18 years old, and said he'd come back. And sure enough, he was true to his word. He came back the next year, heard me sing at the age of 19, took me to New York, where I made my first recording, which jazz-orientated with a lot of very famous jazz musicians, John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet, Gil Evans, Manny Album, all sorts of wonderful jazzers. And I did my best, you know, to keep up with them, but it wasn't until I started working with Mitch Miller that I really found my niche, and that was singing popular songs of the day.
At what point did you maybe figure out, you know, did you start to have an inkling of what songs might be a hit?
Never. The first single recordings that I made were It's Not For Me To Say, When Sunny Gets Blue, a song called Warm and Tender by a new songwriter, Burt Bacharach. Nobody had ever heard of him. And one other one called Wonderful, Wonderful.
Sometimes we walk hand in hand by the sea, and we breathe in the cool, salty air. You turn to me with a kiss in your eyes, and my heart feels a thrill beyond compare.
I went into the studio and recorded those four songs and never heard them again until about, 6 or 8 months later. I was wandering around New York all by myself and I had to take a taxi somewhere. And lo and behold, as I was riding in the taxi, my song came on the radio, first time I'd ever heard it, and I almost wrecked the taxi telling him to stop and listen to my song. And that was the first time I had gotten any inkling about what kind of feeling it was to have a successful career, yeah.
Suddenly you had gone from just somebody who was trying to make it as a recording artist to somebody that everyone would know.
Well, I am completely overwhelmed by the success that I've had over the years. But fortunately, I wasn't blindsided by it. I had started to take voice lessons when I was about 13 years old from a woman who gave me voice lessons free of charge. She was quite good at what she did. And fortunately, I learned enough about voice production to not injure my vocal cords, which is a big deal. And over the years, her kindness to me, because she taught me free of charge, has paid off. I've had minor little occurrences once in a while when I've sung a little bit too much. But other than that, all of her tutoring and all of her knowledge about vocal production really was the basis of my career.
And along those lines, can you talk about what you do to get your voice ready for a concert today?
I don't talk. Yeah, the only thing you can do really is to save your voice. Don't talk. Well, you know, say yes, no, that's about it. And make sure you keep yourself 110% ready to sing. It requires a lot of maintenance, good physical habits. You want to keep yourself strong because you're supporting your vocal qualities from your diaphragm. And it's nice to have a nice, firm belly, which is something that stuck in my mind from the time I was a little kid. And I've been going to the gym now. This is about my 60th or 70th year
wow.
of exercise routines. I exercise about 5 days a week all the time, yeah.
Probably not high jumping, though.
Well, no. I had two hip replacements over the years. But I did go out one day on the golf course with one of my singing buddies, and I said, what's this all about? And, of course, I certainly found out about it, and now my big passion, other than singing, is golf.
Now, maybe this is a strange question, but maybe not. As I was getting ready for this interview, I was remembering a scene from a movie called Diner back in the early 1980s. The movie was actually set in 1959. And in the scene, there are two characters debating who the best singer was to make out to, Sinatra or Mathis.
You know the thing about Sinatra? He's good, but he's too thin. I don't like that.
Yeah, but you can't compare them. Sinatra is the Lord, all right? He's big in movies, he's big in nightclubs, he's big...
Skip that. Let me ask you another question. Scott, when you want to make out, who do you make out to? Sinatra or Mathis?
That's a stupid question.
One question, answer that.
It's irrelevant, I won't answer it. Mathis.
What about you, Shreve?
I'm married, we don't make out.
Do you think at all about the fact that there are generations of people who think of you as the soundtrack to their teenage dating life?
I never did. I just sang. And then somebody said, well, it always sounds romantic, what you sing. I said, yeah, but I sing a lot of stuff. I sing the Cold Idri. I sing Ailey Ailey. You know, I sing jazzy stuff. And they said, no, no, no. Everybody thinks about you as a romantic singer. And I said, well, I used to talk to my dad about it. He said, well, son, maybe that's not so bad. And I guess he was right.
Is there a secret to being a nice guy in a field? You know, the recording industry is not always so nice to its talents. Is there a secret to being a nice guy in a field that is not always so nice?
I think it has a lot to do with your beginnings in whatever business or whatever social situation you get yourself involved with. But you must remember, I've had a lot of help along the way. I've had a lot of people who have counseled me about what would be the best way to go about my career, a personality which you must keep a low profile about, because there's so many challenges from day to day to day in a situation like I'm involved in. And all of it is just a very natural occurrence of what happens when you're raised by someone like my dad and my mom. And I have a very quiet way about doing whatever I do, but I have so much help. There's so many elements involved in just getting one person like myself into a career as I've had. And I've had so many extraordinarily wise people to help me along the way, and I can't think of anything other than that which has kept me very grounded.
As you say, you grew up in San Francisco. Even in the 1950s, I gather, San Francisco was a fairly progressive place, especially when it came to, say, racial attitudes. Can you talk about how things were different as you left home?
The thing about growing up in San Francisco was that at a very early age, I was influenced by, for instance, in school, I became president of the student body. I took classes in opera from the vocal teachers at San Francisco State College. I went to the opera in San Francisco. They had a wonderful opera company. I also frequented all the jazz clubs that my brothers and sisters took me to, because there were so many extraordinary clubs where all the people from all over the world came. And then there were Broadway shows that came through San Francisco. There were nightclubs that a young person, even when I was not of an age to go into a nightclub, when people would say, oh, that's okay, you know, he's grounded, he can stay here, he doesn't have to drink, he can listen to the performers and what have you. And all of that added to the fact that at a very early age, I was influenced and I heard some of the greatest singers, musicians in the world come through San Francisco. And I felt comfortable learning from all of the occasions that I had. And from the time I was about 12 or 13 years old, I met some of these people. And they remembered me when I started to sing. People like Lena Horne, Billy Eckstein, Louis Armstrong, they all came through San Francisco lots of times. And my dad took me to see them, and occasionally I'd get to say hello to them, and my dad, of course, would say, my son's a singer, you know. And they always remembered that. I remember so many of the, especially Billy Eckstein. He said, oh, John, your dad drives me crazy talking about my son sings too. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me to spend my youth in San Francisco. It was immeasurable, absolutely.
There must have been some challenges for you as you were performing before the country changed the way it has.
Yeah, from the time I was 18 and started to travel, went to New York, and of course, after I made my initial recordings, the record company wanted me to go out and find jobs so that I could sing and let the people hear me. And some of these occasions took me to the south of the country. And, you know, there were all sorts of unhappy situations where I got into merely because of my color, not because of my singing. But it was embarrassing from a worldly person like me coming from San Francisco to go to, you know, places where you were denied simply because of the color of your skin. And I was a young kid. This is ridiculous, you know. But, of course, that's all a part of the world. I learned how to handle it. I learned mostly to go to where I was going to be safe, because there were instances when it became dangerous. People threatened me in the South. They wrote me terrible letters, you know, don't come back here anymore. And I had no idea why they were doing that. But all I knew is that, well, that wasn't much fun, so I won't go there anymore. And that's what happens. But, yeah, on the whole, because I had success at an earlier time, I could choose and pick the places where I wanted to go. And at a very early age, I went to Europe, and it was an eye-opener. I had a lot of success in Great Britain with my recordings. And over the years, I've gone back and back and back and had a lot of success with Christmas music over there.
For someone who has performed as many concerts over the years as you have and has recorded as many albums over the years as you have, what makes you happiest today about your life and music?
I'm happiest because I'm surrounded by musicians who are friends of mine, and those are the people that I am in contact with day and night, night and day, all of the time. I have my guitar player, Gil Rigers, for instance. This is his 40th year working with me. My conductor is 30 years. My bass player, 25 years. My drummer, 30 years. And we're pals. And we go all over the world, and we bounce off each other. Each one of us has different responsibilities and different backgrounds in music, and so we are really a family, and that is what absolutely makes it an enjoyment experience. I don't have to deal with a lot of things that I don't know anything about. All I have to do is make sure that I'm ready to perform, and I know that I am blessed in this way, because that isn't always the case with the people who do what I do and have to travel as often and as extensively as I do. But I'm a very, very lucky person.
Well, Johnny Mathis, it has been really rewarding to get to chat with you. I'm so thrilled that we had a chance to talk.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Johnny Mathis recorded his first single in 1955, his first album in 1956, and 78 more albums since then. Just last month, his 1982 album, I Love My Lady, was released for the first time on vinyl for Record Store Day. Mathis plays the show Friday night at the Riverside Theater, and there's a link to more information at WUWM.com.
This song is from his 1973 album, I'm Coming Home, a song called Life is a Song Worth Singing, and it closes out the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Like Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? Life is a song worth singing.